Good evening. I'd like to call to order the Thursday, April 3rd, 2025 meeting of the Shoreline Planning Commission. First up is roll.
Vice Chair Brinson?
Present.
Commissioner Cabe?
Present.
Commissioner Frye?
Present.
Commissioner Hadley?
Present.
Chair Mosier?
Present.
Commissioner Lynn?
Present.
And I have not heard from Commissioner Povich yet, but I'm hoping she will show up.
Me too. Okay. That brings us to next is the approval of the agenda. Everyone okay with the agenda? Any revisions? Nope, super. How about approval of the minutes from our last meeting, which was a long time ago, February 20th? Any comments, revisions? Nope, super. How about public comment? Do you have anybody signed up tonight, Carla?
No one has signed up. Thank you.
Excellent. All right. Well, that brings us right away to our first study item tonight, the bicycle parking development code amendments.
Great. Let me go ahead and share my screen here. Alrighty. Hopefully you all are seeing my screen. Apologies for having to attend virtually. I've got another fun daycare bug from my small infant toddler. So again, my name is Alicia Hallberg. I am a senior planner here at the City of Shoreline. In January, I first presented discussion items related to the city's bike parking code. And in February, I brought you a draft code and a few more discussion items. Now I'm bringing you an updated draft code addressing that feedback and a final few discussion items. This will be the last time the bike code will be presented to you as a standalone item, as we'll be folding this project in with a larger update to the city's parking access and circulation code subchapter, which Steve will present after me. So let's dig in. To start my presentation, I'm going to address a few of the requests that came out of last month's meeting, and then we'll look at the draft code under consideration. And last with the draft code as context, there are a few more discussion items for the commission to consider. Feel free to chime in with questions anytime. I might not see if you have your hand raised or things just because I'm presenting virtual. So the commission presented several questions related to hardscaping requirements and constraints on a site. Bike parking provided outside of existing buildings does need to be on a paved surface, and no change to that requirement is proposed as a part of this code update. Yes, some uses may require more bike parking because we are increasing the amount of bike parking required for a lot of different uses. And this is one, albeit small, piece of the puzzle they'll need to figure out when putting plans together related to hardscaping for their site. The code as drafted does not propose any change to the hardscaping code. Most uses that require bike parking are allowed in the city's commercial zones, which have higher hardscaping allowances than the city's residential zones, or NR zones now. Last, Public Works reviews drainage on sites for compliance with standards in the city's engineering development manual, which encourages the use of pervious pavements and other low impact designs. So hardscaping, while related to impervious surface coverage, is not the same thing. But no changes to hardscaping are proposed as part of this code update. Second, the commission had asked about the size of some of the city's largest commercial developments, such as Costco, Home Depot, and grocery stores around the city. I was able to pull this data from the King County Assessor's Office, which tracks the gross square footage of buildings. So the average gross square footage is 83,000 square feet, while the median size is 94,000. But staff wants to note that bike parking rates aren't for the gross square footage, but the usable square footage. So let's apply this to retail uses as an example. Staff would park the retail sales floor area, not the storage in the back, not hallways, offices, bathrooms, and those spaces. So the chart I provided to you as an attachment to tonight's staff report is an overestimation of the parking required for a site. And unfortunately, several of those big box stores were developed prior to the city's incorporation or in the early days of shoreline permitting. So we don't have great floor plan records for each building. It might be pretty difficult to track down. So my apologies for not having more concise data about the sales floor areas there, but we've got what we've got. Next, can bike parking areas be located in required outdoor space areas? That's a great question and one of the discussion items for tonight. The new NR, or Neighborhood Residential Design Standards, state that parking areas and vehicular areas do not qualify as outdoor space. So in NR zones, they could not overlap. But the townhome design standards and the commercial multifamily zone design standards don't have such prohibitions. So staff would like direction from the commission on whether these spaces should be allowed to overlap. Staff generally supports overlapping requirements provided their separate minimum dimensions and functions are not diminished by sharing the space. And then last, what feedback do we have from apartment managers? So unfortunately, response rates from apartment managers weren't great, although two more did respond after the staff report was finalized last week. Earlier this week, they responded. So all have bike parking in accordance with the city's current requirements. Four say their bike rooms are being used. Two said they were poorly used. And one of those two poorly used buildings said they did have theft issues on site. So after hearing your feedback at the last meeting in late February, I went ahead and made some changes to the code to better align with your direction. This included some fairly large changes to the short-term bike parking requirements, including some of the rates. We removed the tiers, we added caps or maxes, and added single family developments with 30 or more units to, I know we had discussed 20 at the meeting, but 30 aligns for when SEPA is triggered. So we like to align with other parts of the code when possible. For other changes, I added some requirements for what needs to be shown on plans. We removed the strict surveillance requirements as discussed at the last meeting. And then I worked on long-term bike parking maximum rates for multifamily uses for some time, trying to figure out what that magic number might be for what a hard cap would be or different rates for different sizes. But ultimately, I'm looking for more direction from the commission on this topic. Larger apartment buildings are more likely to be located near transit and trails based on the city's zoning. The city has already followed the APBP recommended rate for some time. And feedback from developers indicated that the rates might be a little high. Feedback from apartment managers, as we just discussed, indicated that some bike parking spaces are empty, while others are seeing at least some use. Should larger buildings have a lower rate than smaller buildings? Should there be a cap? These are things I would love for some direction on. Last, related to this, I also included language allowing for up to 80% of long-term bike parking for multifamily uses to be provided within individual apartment units, so long as the development overall has a small fix-it or repair station for, you know, pumping up tires, repairing flats. The city of Portland allows for parking in units and has a similar requirement. I discussed these requirements with a few planners on their staff to better understand how administration of that code works. It seems like this could prevent maybe some of the very large bike rooms that are underutilized that we've been getting some feedback from developers on, and might address some theft concerns that have come up as concerns anecdotally. So that might be a good direction to head. All right, so I've highlighted here, I'll breeze through these pretty quick because we looked at them in late February, and you've already reviewed the staff report, I'm sure, too. So the highlights cover some of the changes. So again, no more tiers when looking at the short-term rates. So that's all been condensed largely to follow the APBP recommended rates. We've added in a short-term requirement for single-family developments with 30 or more units at a rate of 1 per 15 dwellings. So a 30-unit development would have two short-term parking stalls or just one U-rack because you can park a bike on either side of it. We also added max rates for several uses. A maximum of 12 seemed appropriate. Again, if each rack parks two bikes, that's no more than six loops as a maximum. That seemed reasonable. Of course, these are maximums on what they're required to provide. A developer or a business owner can choose to provide more if they would like. It's just we won't require any more than 12. And here again, more short-term rates. We also increased the K-12 schools rate. I did check with Shoreline Public Schools. They don't have a rate that they use for parking their various schools. And then long-term rates. Again, we had discussed that cap, and I'm looking for a little bit more direction on the max or cap for multifamily long-term uses in particular. Otherwise, no real changes here, except for the design, which we got rid of that surveillance requirement and then added in that they could be in unit. All right, so discussion questions. Should long-term bike parking for multifamily uses have a maximum? If so, what should that maximum be? Or should different size buildings have different rates for multifamily? Should short-term bike parking spaces be allowed to overlap with required outdoor open space? And should developments be required to provide a shared bike repair station in order to park in unit? So those are my three discussion items. That's all I've got for you. I'm happy to keep these discussion questions up for you all to consider.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Alicia. Let's just do them in order, shall we? Leslie, go ahead.
I have a clarifying question. If you could go back to the slide with the draft code on it, where it has single family and middle housing, and then this one or either one. This one is fine. Is the code clear what middle housing is compared to multifamily? I know that we've talked a ton about it. I just want to make sure that when we're talking about something like a fourplex, that that's clear to someone that that would be in the top one and not the bottom one, et cetera.
Yes, it is defined in the code. I'm happy to pull up that definition.
It was just checking a box in my head because in my day job, it is often confused.
Oh, yes. Planning team was discussing ADUs versus middle housing just this week.
Exactly.
Definitions are always helpful to have.
Okay.
Here, middle housing, yes, has its own definition here. I mean, that was a part of the code update that just took place in January.
Great.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie. I've forgotten the questions. Would you mind going back to the question?
Yeah. Back we go.
I think I remember them. But...
There we go.
Thank you. Let's do them in order. Long-term parking in multifamily buildings, should it have a maximum? Or should there be another way of thinking about it? Colt, please. See your finger.
I think a maximum is definitely a good idea. I've seen projects where you have a lot of units, and so it just gets unfeasible to find the place to put the bike, and they just end up getting crammed into places where they're even less usable than maybe they typically would be. As far as what the maximum is, I don't really have any numbers backing this up other than kind of a gut feeling of just seeing what is easily kind of stuck in is maybe 80. I still think 20 is a little too low. But I think 80 can reasonably be found in typical large multifamily.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'll go. I mean, I'm with Cole. I do think it probably should have a maximum. I know when I look at, I guess the building's not open yet, but there's the one right at the 185th light rail station. You can see this long, long, long bike room. And you have to wonder, even next to a station, is it ever going to truly be full? But I guess I am a little torn with my own answer. I've said that now that we do allow them in units, though. So if you look, think of it as allowing 80% of them in a unit, would that change your opinion? Because then the bike room itself will be smaller, and then the units just have to accommodate it.
So is there any size requirement to the unit to say that it's now capable of housing a bike, or they just have to put a little note on the plan that says, park your bike in the unit?
Alicia, can you? Sorry, thanks.
Yeah, they need to have a space that accommodates the minimum bike size. So we have a size defined in the code. Here, pull up.
It has to be like a closet storage space that is of a certain size, right?
Or an alcove, I think it said.
Yeah, exactly.
So potentially if you're putting, I'm thinking out loud, potentially if you're putting bikes in units, you are either increasing the size of the unit to accommodate the bike, and therefore decreasing the total number of units, potentially, because space is finite. Or you were, right?
Mm-hmm.
Chris is watching me do math in real time in my head.
No, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, now we're, I know the next time we talk about this, we're coupling it with parking reductions. Mm-hmm. So there is more floor area available.
Yeah.
But I don't, I'm sorry, Alicia, I can't, is it in there? Is there a size in there? I remember it said alcove. I remember the descriptions of places, but I don't remember it had a specific dimension.
Yeah, it references this diagram. So 2 feet by 6 feet by 3 1/3 feet. Okay. And it can be either vertical or horizontal.
Oh, there it is. Thank you. Right there. I just didn't get that far down. I mean, I think in my mind, I'm okay with it being in the unit because that's like effectively a credenza, the space of a credenza.
Yeah.
You're adding.
To especially if it can be vertical.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So knowing that it could go in a unit, is there a max? Do you think there's a maximum still?
No, that kind of alleviates my concern for having those huge bike rooms.
I'm sorry, Alicia, remind me, in the thing, I know there was, I have the ratio, the average size of a building for retail in my head. Was there an average number of units? I know the list said there was some that was like 11 and some that was like 290 or something. There was quite a range. Do we have like an average size apartment?
Oh gosh, let me pull up the chart real quick. I think I did provide the, it'll take me just a minute to pull up. Sorry, I don't have it off the top of my head.
I can probably find, oh, I'm sorry, it's right there. It's right.
Yeah.
I guess there's some in the 70s. I guess I'm okay with there not being a maximum still. But I didn't know if there was, like, if you look at it, there's a number of them in the 400 or 500s, then a group in the 200s, and then there's some that are sub 100. And I don't know if it would make sense to have it here, because at 500 units, that's a lot of bikes. It is, and you're getting into a lot of storage again. Or is that just over? I don't want to overly complicate it.
So 500 units, how many bikes? One.
Sorry. So for example, for 500 unit, how if we do not set the minimum and the maximum?
200.
Long term.
So a 500 unit apartment building would require 250 bike parking spaces under the current code and the proposed code. And if 80% of those were allowed in units, that means 200 would be in units and 50 would be in a bike parking room.
Which I think if we're,
in that case, I think we should set a maximum.
I think that the possible place, thinking about the sort of math around development, right, is that you're going to end up with the minimum amount in a bike room and the maximum amount in units, because that's essentially just a closet.
Mm-hmm. It's flexible.
And it's flexible, which is a positive. So I actually don't. We may end up with less bike parking and more closets as we go in this. Like, that might be the unintended swing, which, you know, as an apartment, as a former apartment dweller, that's not a bad thing. So I think that, I mean, I don't necessarily think, I think with the in-unit allowance, I don't think there needs to be a maximum. Because even with 50 bikes, in a bike room, that seems okay.
Sorry, just to clarify. So we will still have, minimum of the standalone long-term storage. So that is that number is where what we are discussing, like we want.
I think we were, at least from my perspective, I was thinking of the maximum as a holistic maximum. And yeah. knowing that it was just 500 because it was an easy math, there's 250, and that 80% of those would go in a unit,
right.
20% would go in a room, and but the maximum is the 250. And
right. Okay, I see. So then we, so if we set the minimum of what is required to stand alone, that will make sense. At least we will have X amount of standalone parking space.
In the
20%.
Yeah, the 20%.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. Wow. Okay. Thanks.
Bradley or Lauren, any thoughts?
I mean, I think it does make sense with considering in, you know, allowing in unit spaces to kind of include that maximum, kind of like what we were talking about with, yeah, like 80%. Do we, but like here's, so I guess if the units are not, like if there's not enough units to meet that threshold, so that we still need to have like a room or several rooms outside of units that would just be for dedicated to bike storage, long-term bike storage. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
I think so. I mean, I think for me, it's like there's two ways of looking at it. One is like, even if you, I'm just using the giant building just because I can only do the math in my head for 500 right now. Like I'm looking at that one and saying like, you know, is 250 just too much to ask regardless of the configuration of them? And that's kind of where I'm starting from. It's like, if you just look at 100% of the required, is 250 too many? And then if that's okay, like does that 100% change if you assume that most of them are in units? And if you're not riding a bicycle, you do get a slightly bigger apartment, though apartments are justified by rent, so, or by square footage. So your rent might be conversely a little bit higher, but you have more space to use. And is that okay? Because then you're still only saying 20% of them go into a room, which is a more reasonable sized room that still lets ground floor areas be. That's kind of the thought process, but also like you look at the 250, should we just say that's too many and like you should only ever have to provide 80 because people don't bike?
Now that you put it that way, it does sound within 500 unit, 250 required bike, long-term bike parking is high. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the number that's reasonable?
Yeah, I think, with those numbers, it does seem really high, especially considering our bike study kind of shows that we don't have, like, we're kind of lagging in ridership anyways. But with, I'm curious what you guys think, if we're saying that bike storage in unit will kind of meet these standards, wouldn't that be increasing the costs? Because it'll be increasing the square footage of these units. And making kind of going against some of our affordable housing goals. So that's kind of.
Uh-huh. Lauren, what do you think?
Well, the thing that came to mind is 250 seemed really high. Now, granted, I don't ride a bike. I physically can't, so it's hard for me to put my head around this. But as soon as I started thinking about more than one person in a unit, like a family or a couple, then I was like, oh, suddenly those spots get gobbled up pretty quickly if you've got two or three bikes per unit and at maybe only a handful of units that have families. So that's what came to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was an apartment dweller in my 20s, I had my bike in my one bedroom apartment. So, and I called it up three flights of stairs.
It's where you hung your coat. It's where I hung my coat.
Yes.
I'm concerned about the rents, but I mean, the reality is that amenity areas also get fact put into rent in a different factor, so at least you know if you don't ride a bike, you have extra space. But is there, do we want to look at like tiers then within size of apartment buildings? Like just looking at whoever made this chart, thank you, Alicia, the colors are very helpful to group in my head. Do we want to like look at it? Because there's a lot of them, the 500 is kind of an outlier, and even the 300s, there's a lot that are in the 200s. Is it like if you have 1 to 100 units, it's one number, 2 to 3, it's another number, and more than 3, just to like set maximums at a,
so,
or am I complicating it?
That feels complicated to me. I might say like, okay, we see most apartment buildings are less than 250, I'm making math up. And that whatever, so 250 would be the max?
Sure.
Which would be?
125.
Yeah. I told you I can't do math at this point. But no, my question, Alicia, do we have, I mean, I know it totally depends on the environment and on the jurisdiction, but do you have examples of maximums that folks have set that might put this in context a little bit? Like, are all cities having 250 bike spaces in 500 unit apartment buildings?
Gosh, I would need to look back at the comparison study. I do not remember off the top of my head where my different maximums.
Okay. I mean, I think as we've talked to it, I would be okay setting a maximum now that I've talked to death. I think I would probably do it at like 125 because that seems like still an objectively high number of bikes, at least in this near term part of the city. And no, and I, but I would still stick with the 80% could go in a unit, because then that leaves you with, it leaves you with a reasonable size bike.
25, right?
I don't know. I can't do the math.
I think that's a nice summary.
100 bikes in a room. No, right. That's
so
not right.
A 25
thank
bike,
you.
Yeah. Bike room.
Don't make me, yeah.
With a fix-it station.
With a fix-it station, yes. Okay, so summarize, how's everyone feeling about a maximum? I've just thrown 125. Is that a good number? Is that a bad number?
It was based on my eyeballing.
It was based on Leslie's eyeballing, which seems reasonable.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm good with the maximum. As far as numbers go, I'm not super clear, but your logic sounds reasonable to me.
Okay. Alicia, is that good? And if you maybe we'd say yes, a maximum, I think that's a good number. And maybe just if you're going through the numbers and like a comparison, if there's a number that seems better for the next time, just let us know.
Yeah, I know the SEPA trigger for multifamily is 60 units, so I was trying to think of that, but it seems like this would be a bit higher than that. Yeah. But I'll think of other areas in the code where this might overlap. I did some quick math on the chart. The average apartment building size is 184 units, and the median is 192.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. Does anyone else have any thoughts on maximums? Do you want to move to the next question?
Thumbs up.
Next question. All right, super. Short-term bike parking areas, and should they be allowed to overlap with required outdoor space? Alicia, remind me for this context, is this in every instance or just in like the neighborhood residential where there's?
Yeah, so currently the code prohibits overlap in the neighborhood residential zones, and I think there is potential to overlap where the single family attached requirements apply, which is the MUR zones and TC zones. And then also in the commercial multifamily zones, so generally commercial zones. We could also look at including an update to the language in the NR zones, but we're probably hesitant to touch that section again after we just approved it.
Fair. Okay. Thoughts? Michelle, please.
Parking, I mean, bike parking within outdoor, it's a less intrusive type of space. So I support to have it overlap with open space counting.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
I agree with, I just don't think it impedes on the open space. I think it makes it more flexible and easier for people to incorporate.
I think so long as it doesn't reduce minimum requirements for the other uses of the open space, I think allowing for overlap is, yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. Leslie?
I agree.
Sweet. I'm going to make everyone say yes or no. Lauren, how do you feel?
I do agree.
Excellent.
I'm not being strong-armed.
Okay, thank you. I agree as well. That one was easier, thank goodness. I guess we kind of talked about the third one already as part of the maximums, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. So when we say developments, are we specifically talking about multifamily developments with this?
Yeah, that's how the code is written now. Okay. It's only when providing in-unit spaces.
So it's not all developments are required to have a bike repair station, only if they're doing it in-unit?
Correct.
Okay.
Are we talking like a dedicated space for bike repair stations? Like if everyone's bike is in working order, it's just going to be a space that's not used? It could be like a multi-use repair station for other types of equipment or things. What do you think about that?
In my mind, it's a bike repair station, which, I mean, when I see them like in office buildings, it's like everything's on a stand and you can hold your bike and it's got like a pump next to it. It's really for like tire repairs and putting your chain back on and things like that. I guess it might, in theory, have a pump, so you could pump up like a sports ball or something like that. But it's pretty in your mind, Alicia, when you're writing it, it's a pretty single use kind of object, though. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty small, usually on like a very tall bollard kind of situation where you can rest your bike and use a couple tools, hex wrenches and the like.
Thank you. What do you think?
I think that sounds like a snazzy benefit. If I had a bike.
Yeah, thank you. I think I was picturing in my head like this, like a workbench and all this stuff. But yeah, that sounds much more reasonable to me. Than what I was picturing in my head.
Excellent. Leslie, how about you?
I like that the requirement is tied to in-unit storage. So I think that that's a good connection.
Cool.
I agree.
Misha, how do you feel?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Sounds good to me, too. We did it. All right.
Was there any other feedback on the draft code either?
I didn't have any. I appreciated that you changed the schools to have more and amended some of the other ones. So I didn't have any other comments. Does anybody else have any other feedback? Nope. Looks like no. We like it.
Great. Right. Thank you all for your time. I really appreciate it. This is great direction.
Thank you, Alicia. All right, that brings us to our next study item tonight, which is the development code amendments to eliminate parking minimums citywide.
Is that it?
No.
Because you had three in there.
Oh.
I don't know which one.
I'm just going to
There we go. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know. Okay, and you know how to make it big, right?
And we can't see it.
Oh. Okay, sorry. You gotta share first. You know how to do this.
Do I?
I don't know. No. It's this one.
You ready?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We were just discussing that your font is nice and big so we can all read it too.
Good. Yeah, helpful for me also. So thank you, Steve Saffron, Senior Planner, City of Shoreline. So why are we discussing eliminating parking minimums throughout the city? Land use policy 3.2, newly adopted land use policy 3.2, directs staff to update parking regulations to eliminate minimum parking ratios and to create flexible and predictable parking standards for residential and commercial uses. So why do we have parking minimums? Historically, the city wants to ensure that residential and commercial businesses supply enough parking to guard against spillover parking impacts to surrounding residents and to provide convenient and safe access to buildings. Some of the reasons behind the elimination of minimum parking regulations include the cost of parking that makes housing development infeasible. Parking mandates hamper the creation of homes and jobs by spending significant resources on the storage of cars. The national average of a parking space is running from 10 to 24,000 per stall, while those costs in the Puget Sound region are as high as 50,000 per stall for structured parking. All the space dedicated to parking results in inefficient use of land, especially in areas that are meant to encourage compact land uses, such as those served with frequent mass transit. Parking areas also create separations between streets and sidewalks in the buildings that they serve, creating less pedestrian-friendly streets, reducing walkability, and encouraging more driving. As noted on the slide above and during Council's evaluation of the comprehensive plan, many cities and counties have eliminated parking minimums in their city codes. Specific case studies from Spokane and Beaverton, Oregon are included in your staff report. And as staff works through these development code amendments related to parking, we'll continue to study other cities and kind of incorporate the best practices and bringing those back to the commission as part of our review. Looking at what we currently have on the books, there are a lot of references for parking. There are more references to parking than there are trees, community, and housing combined. Current regulations ensure that most uses require more space for cars than the actual building that is being served. Plus, if you don't own a car, you still get a parking space. In addition, the code also allows many ways to reduce parking based on proximity to transit, green building programs, and affordable housing programs. To illustrate some of those areas, recently adopted development code amendments to implement the comprehensive plan show the extent of where parking is not currently required based on proximity to high capacity and frequent transit service. Those being middle housing units a half mile from high capacity transit and ADUs within half mile of frequent transit surface. These all areas in the Hatch do not require parking currently. In addition to policy LU 3.2 that specifically addresses eliminating parking minimums, there is policy support moving forward with the elimination of parking, such as these policies listed on your screen. Policy Natural Environment 1.1 and Land Use 9.6 speak to reducing parking to support high density housing and to reduce hardscaped areas. Policy 8, Housing 9.2 speaks to reducing parking demand by constructing housing near transit. Going forward, there will be arguments for and against the elimination of parking minimums. Staff will present both sides of that argument as the proposed development code amendments move through the public process and as those are brought back to the Planning Commission for discussion and the City Council. Staff did go to the council to ask for initial direction on these proposed development code amendments, and there were some major topics that kind of transpired from that meeting, being council was unanimous in saying this should apply citywide, so no area should be exempt from the elimination of parking minimum. So staff will be studying this in a citywide context. There was discussion around parking enforcement. Council agreed that parking management and parking enforcement will be important moving forward, and they are talking about directing more resources towards that in the future. Circulation management was a big topic, and this would include on-street parking management, loading zones, and courier parking and circulation. Council was concerned that users like FedEx and UPS are stopping in the street to deliver packages, and how are we going to manage those type of uses, have them not park in the street, and that would kind of be a function of how we work with Public Works and how we do that kind of curb management going forward. The other two, ADA parking and EV parking were subjects that came up, and also should there be minimum parkings for certain uses? When we talk about big box stores, do we want to look at having, you know, some parking for certain uses or not? Discussion questions. So these are in your staff report. We'll go through these. Let me skip over this one now, just to kind of give you a general schedule. After this meeting, with discussion and direction from the commission, staff will work through some proposed code amendments and start bringing those back, maybe in chunks, depending how, you know, extensive it gets. So scheduled April through June, having discussion, public hearing, with this ultimately going to the council for some action, and hopefully July or July into August. So it's fast track, so it'll be a lot of work going for the next couple of months. But anyway, that's my presentation, and I have some questions here on the screen that we can go through and kind of get some initial direction from the Planning Commission.
Excellent, thank you. Before we hit the questions, is anybody, these specific questions, is there any clarifying questions that does anyone have before we dig into it? No? Okay. How about number one, parking circulation load management plans? Should we require them? Should we not require them?
We should say that staff and the developers we've spoken to would rather not have additional parking or circulation plans, one for them to prepare and two for staff to approve and administer. We hear a lot from developers about predictability and the speed of how fast they can get permits. So this would just, in staff's opinion, be one more thing that would slow down the permit process. So
actually I do have a question in this one. So having done things, a lot of daycare centers in my career, where we do have to do is this essentially like a traffic and parking study in some ways, like where they would have to provide like pickup, drop off, like peak hours and things like that, where you have to hire a consultant to do it? Or is this something that your average architect, civil engineer could put together?
I would say that typically staff would be looking toward a professional traffic engineer to be preparing something like that. And so I think as commission thinks about this question, that thinking and being mindful of like what the desired outcome or like what the objective of the study would be. You know, I think we posed this question because it was a topic that some of the council members were putting out there as they were discussing parking minimums and eliminating them. But without a parking requirement, I think there's a legitimate question of what is the benefit of a parking plan, mm-hmm. right? So I would just put that out there.
That's fair. Thank you. Leslie.
I have a clear. Can either one of you talk a little bit more about what these plans are in places where they're in place? I'm not sure I'm clear on what is being asked about the thing.
Thank you. Sorry, I take it for granted.
Well, we've required parking management plans in the past.
Okay.
Something like a circulation or loading, we've never seen or we've never required anything like that. It's just whatever's been in the development code as mm-hmm. a requirement. You know, certain businesses over a square footage require loading spaces, so you have to show your loading zones on your site plan and how that works. But if we don't require any parking spaces, how are we gonna manage drop-offs, deliveries, moving trucks? So it's sort of a new thing, at least for us.
Yeah, I would just jump in too. Sometimes, and I think that what was maybe being referred to in this context is like a demand management plan, where you're trying to, or you're implementing strategies to help offset parking demand. And so if you're an employer, for example, you'd be offering transit passes to your employees as a way to encourage them to use other means of transportation to come to work rather than drive their car and park. Or you're allocating a certain number of stalls to carpool parking or something like that, right? And then if you're a multifamily development, you might look at like shared parking arrangements, right? So if it's mixed use, looking at the demand and kind of offsetting demands of your commercial space relative to your residential spaces, and demonstrating that those, you know, the parking demand is being met because you have alternating peak demands for the different uses. So I think, yeah, and in addition to what Steve was talking about with like load, unload, and everything, it's also just sort of this fundamental operational side, which can get really kind of into the weeds and can get very site-specific and use-specific very quickly. And so that's where, you know, from staff's perspective, it's like if we're eliminating parking minimums, being really thoughtful and intentional of like when we would want to be evaluating a parking management plan.
I think as I listen to you, one, parking management plan doesn't make sense to me if we're not requiring parking. So I'll put that there. I am having a little bit of a hard time, and maybe this is just in other parts of the code. If we're truly, so if an apartment building goes up and doesn't require parking, but we there's still something in the code that deals with solid waste and load zones and that sort of thing. So the garage components would still be addressed elsewhere. This is just about like individual spaces for parking?
There is, in the code, mechanical spaces, waste management spaces. But yeah, this would be for parking spaces.
So this would, yeah, when we say eliminate parking minimums, so in our code, we have the table, you know, you need X number of stalls per unit, X number of stalls per square foot of office space. So this would eliminate all of those parking ratios. What would remain would still be your parking access aisle widths and like some of those design standards of what you would want so that most often people are still going to be building parking. You want it to be functioning. You want right. the access to be wide enough. You want the stalls to be of a certain size. So we would maintain or recommend maintaining those standards in the code, maintaining like loading zones and things like that within the code, but not dictating how much parking should be built.
Michelle, please.
I want to raise that now that minimum or the required parking is not there, then usually the accessible parking is dictated by the total number of your parking count. So that means we should come up with a reasonable number to require bare minimum, I mean the basic number of required, like how many units. So now it's the how many units we need to require, or like say how big of your retail space, then minimum of accessible parking a business or retail need to provide.
So ADA spaces and EV spaces are percentage of what the parking requirement is currently. But there are ADA minimums in the building code. So instead of having it defined in the development code, we would just rely on what the building code has to, what the requirement is.
I see.
There, it's like a, there's a threshold, like a square footage threshold. Once you get over that, you have to start providing ADA parking spaces.
I see. So that will not be affected.
That part won't be affected. And again, yeah, if we don't have a parking minimum, but you know, developer builds some amount of parking, some amount would have to be ADA and EV ready based on what they do provide.
I see. And then another clarifying question that, so if say we built into the code saying loading and loading zone is required, does that need to be count as part of this? I mean, does it need to be a management plan, or can it be built into 20 units, 100 unit apartment? I cannot imagine that there is no load unload zone and visitor parking area. I know the developer or the management company definitely will build that in. However, I think those are the basic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have loading zones are part of the development code currently, so we can look at that section to see if it can be amended somehow, like to address not just loading, but maybe you know short-term drop-off, pickup parking, and
right.
Also working with Public Works, how you know as part of the frontage or curb management, can that be built in to perhaps their you know frontage improvements? And now out front here we have a pull in, like
that's
you
right.
know a short-term drop-off thing. I mean, there's different ways to manage those if it's you know on site or if it's part of the curb management, but we can bring back certain different options as we go forward, perhaps you know look at other buildings and how they manage that.
I think since this is new, this is like new territory, it might be good to pull those other references like loading zones and solid, all the things that we would normally think of kind of bundled when we think of parking.
Mm-hmm.
If we could just sort of see what else is out there, and then we can take those off our list because they're already covered.
We have them. I mean,
I'm sure
to be amended.
I think to us, they're new.
Yeah.
So if we could sort of build some baseline and understanding about all those other pieces, it might help us move through the other ones.
So I guess this was kind of more of an introduction kind of direction
of
what we have, and then as we'll start bringing actual code to you, code sections, how these are divided up, and then start playing with you know what should be amended, what should
right. It's just for me, it's hard to talk about a loading management plan without knowing what loading zones are already in the code, because if they're already covered,
not much.
Okay, so I mean this. I think we also jumped into a really hard question.
Yeah, you started with a real detailed one.
We're trying to.
You wanted to make sure you still were capable of thinking about it, though.
Thanks.
So I guess just to clarify, then, so I'm hearing like load zones, which can be like curb management and like a loading dock, right? For maybe like Trader Joe's across the street has a loading dock. So I think it kind of lands into two categories. We can bring back like just the basic design standards around stall dimensions and access aisle width and things like that. There's landscaping standards within parking areas as well. I think those live within the parking subchapter. So, we can kind of bring back the whole menu of things.
Not all 272.
No.
Probably like 270.
Okay. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you. Lauren, I see you ready.
Yes, Steve, I just wanted to thank you for taking into consideration the permitting process and that was your goal. So I just wanted to say I really liked hearing that.
Anyone else? I think I'm with y'all. I think doing a management plan, it adds a level of capriciousness to it. Like you don't know. Like you have to put together a study and present it, and it opens it up to somebody interpreting your study. Whereas if you just said, you know, do this, then you know what you're getting. I mean, you have to make some kind of educated reasoning while telling people what to do. And I think, I don't know, I look at most of these things as we're a city, and we're now a city. Cities are kind of inconvenient sometimes, too, so you're not going to get it right, so we're making our best guesses. So with what Andrew said, I think I'm more interested in understanding what our loading requirements, like if it's just part of building, or is it like actually part of like an overall public works, like street management plan, where we start to allocate where loading zones should be, since we have such an erratic kind of urban form right now with tall buildings next to single-family homes, some of which have and do not have sidewalks. So I think for me, I'm more interested in figuring out that than like making everybody hire someone to put together a plan.
I think the other part with that I'm thinking about, just to pick up off of, is we have a lot of unimproved right-of-way, right? And lack of curbs and no sidewalks. And I think as we move through this, it would be helpful for us to think through and visualize. I'm thinking about something that Commissioner Povich has said. Mm-hmm. Sort of, because I think one of the conflicts that will come to us in the future is, and it happens to me now, I'm not sure where I can park in the right-of-way, even though I know I can park in the right-of-way, because it all feels like it's part of someone's yard. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that the city generally should, as we're going through this transition period over the next decade or so, I think thinking through like how are we all adapting to that is an important step in all of this. I am fully supportive of eliminating parking minimums, but want to think more about how we've transitioned to, even without curbs, how might we make street parking feel accessible when it's often visually someone's front yard.
I think, you had a line item about education, and one of the things there, I think that's when there's a house just around the corner, I walk past it all the time on my way places, that very clearly has no parking signs on the right of way, that is very clearly city-owned land. So I think that's part of our education. Letting people know that, while it may seem like it's yours, it is in fact not yours.
And to be clear, even if there are curbs and sidewalks,
people still do that.
I have received notes on my car that I cannot park in front of someone's house.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on question number one, or do you want to go to question number two? Number two, okay. Are there any uses in which we think we should still provide parking minimums? Or should we just take the holistic approach of it's, you know, you don't have to and you do what you want? What your business needs dictate.
Costco is going to provide parking, right? Because that's,
Right.
Maybe people know their customers, right?
Yeah, Fred Meyer's never going to build a store without parking. That's just, so instead of letting Fred Meyer, pay some consultant to do the research to figure out how much parking is most beneficial to them, we would be stepping in and picking a number. And so I don't think there's any reason for a minimum for these, because there's no world where Costco is not going to put parking at their store. Mm-hmm. And for there to be a Costco for there much longer if they do.
Yeah, exactly. What does everyone else think?
Yeah, I agree. I think leaving it up to them to figure that out makes sense. They're not, just Costco's gonna have parking.
I guess I have a related question to this, is if there's not a minimum, should there still be a maximum, though? Since that can be your point. Okay, so you're giving me the look like, damn it, you stole what I said. So is that, just to look at the other way around, is there no minimum, but since we're trying, the part of the notion of this is removing impervious surface in Heat Island, so do we want to take that into account now or not take? So I think if you think of it in the current state, you're probably going to get parking lots as big as they are if you were to build something new.
And we do have maximums currently in the code. If you were,
okay,
it's like 20% over the maximum. You have to like have a director's approval, and then any of that hardscape would have to be some sort of pervious. So it gets harder now in the code if you want to go over.
Okay. Yeah. How would that work if we didn't have minimums, though? Because right now there's a...
Yeah, that would make sense anymore.
Yeah. We have to redo all of our math, because everything's a percentage of something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the whole code section is going to be...
It's going to be a lot of math.
It's going to be a lot of amendments in there.
Yeah,
so exciting.
Well, no, not a lot of math, but...
I was just going to add, I believe that cities that don't have minimums and choose to have maximums, it's just a hard number, or you're applying the ratio in just a new way. It's no longer a minimum, it's a maximum, and then you increase it.
Chris, you mentioned daycares earlier.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, we talk about ADA parking, I'm also thinking, I'm thinking about families. I'm thinking about young families with kids in asleep in back seats, particularly. Daycares are required to have pickup, drop off, et cetera, as to get licensing. I'm looking at you because you just mentioned it. I think it is yes.
I don't remember that specifically. It was whenever I did them, it was actually more haggling with people like these lovely people about how we were going to mess up traffic in the city. Because you have, I did like 200 and 300 kid ones though. So everyone, you'd have like hundreds of kids get, like kind of like school drop off where like everyone descends on one little parcel all at once.
So I don't know what to do with my like concern about young families, because often that's a category of folks who are in cars because that's the only way to move tiny screaming humans from one place to another.
In Shoreline.
In Shoreline and in Capitol Hill where my infant was born a long time ago. So I don't know what to do with this. I just want to put it in the air and you'll probably hear me come back to it a few times as we go through.
It's almost like it's almost like a FedEx, so don't you go drop your kid off and then.
Well, daycares, yes. I'm thinking in general, if you are, so ADA parking is required.
Mm-hmm.
But as a, unless you have a placard, you can't park in the ADA parking. Mm-hmm. So if there's no parking mm-hmm. and you have a small, a young family, you're a little out of luck. If there's no required parking. So I'm not suggesting it, that mm-hmm. we change this. It's just something that I think we need to be cognizant of and maybe think through strategies. Misha has the answers.
Good. Misha,
not the answer.
Give us the answers.
Well, I'm thinking, can we not call that, like say, no, that's not parking, like you said. It's not parking, but something to resolve this type of, like just a short period of time, the rush in, let's say call it staging area.
Actually, I think I confused things. So I think daycares, I think under licensing are required to have pickup drop off spots. So I think even if the city says there are no, I think under licensing standards, they're required to have pickup drop. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about like in a retail center, if we have required ADA, but that developer decides we don't need any parking, then you've got a few other user types who don't quite fit, mm-hmm. who are mm-hmm. car dependent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm thinking about, and I don't know what to do with that, and that would probably fit into this number two space. So I just wanted to say it out loud to acknowledge those struggles and for us to sort of think about it.
So. May I suggest, so those are not called accessible parking. It doesn't have a universal accessible symbol. However, there are designated area that's called needing family parking requirement.
They used to have a pregnancy sign on the Bellevue. There was a pregnant person sign in the parking lot. And a little bit like the veteran sign at Home Depot. Like I don't know what to do with this thought, but it's just a little bit of a, you know, when we think about people with disabilities, they, you know, we have ADA protections. We don't have that same thing. And as a single parent with two children, it's a whole situation.
So how do you look at that I feel like some of that's predicated on a parking lot almost. But if you imagine our code is written around creating things that are more like North City or Ridgecrest within the city or like a normal like inner city neighborhood where there's street parking.
Street parking. Mm-hmm.
So, but that I think that's not in here. Like, I think some of that is like accessible spots on the street. Or like, is there that kind of zone? Or is it just that is just part of the hassle of like parking on the street? You may have to drive around the block to find a spot.
I'm just entering it into the conversation. Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting anything mm-hmm. needs to be done. It's just a thought to keep present as we're working through this. That's all.
Yeah, I think that curb management's going to be a big piece because, you know, could have signs for, you know, food trucks only or for, ADA only. Or
it's a little bit of this transition. This, we're in that liminal space between completely unimproved right-of-way, no curbs, and the future where we can manage them.
Yeah, and even if someone does have, the developer does have space on site, maybe it would work better on the street anyway. It's more convenient, but yeah, it's, yeah.
Any other
things
thoughts?
To think through.
We're still on number two.
We're still on number two, yeah. Should, I mean, I guess back to the original question, I think maybe we got a little off topic. Is there any use with which we can imagine we'd want requirements? To, are we all feeling okay? It's okay to say no. No minimum, rather. Okay. Super. Okay. Let's go on to number three then. EV parking. Should it be required? When parking's provided, should it be a requirement? Colt, please.
I think like the percentages should be kept the same if you choose to provide parking, but EV shouldn't be required just on its own. If you're not going to put parking spaces, you shouldn't have to require vehicle charging.
I know the building code has some requirements around providing at least EV like ready, you know, facilities and in new buildings, multifamily. So those would still apply, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do other people think? Bradley.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you. I agree in principle. I'm a little worried that the idea of removing parking is part of its cost of parking. Part of it is carbon emissions. And part of it is like heat islands. But I don't like EV charging, to be perfectly honest. I'd rather I spend our money having people put in sidewalks or pay for transit. So I feel a little bit of like this is, we're not, like by requiring it still, we're not undoing the problem we're trying to do because we're still providing a means for a different kind of independent mode of transportation. Knowing some people still need that, I'm not saying everybody, but I don't know if it should be a requirement in my mind. I'd rather see us focus on creating the things that are in the plan, which is not a driving-oriented thing. Because the EV car still requires a road that has to be repaved, and that's my own personal feeling. Mm-hmm. So I would say no almost holistically, but I just as an overall removal of cars from life. But
if stalls are provided, then a certain percentage would...
I think the energy code probably dictates that too, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and we'll find out exactly what that is, but okay.
I agree with you.
I mean, I would say if there's a code that we can opt out of, I would potentially look at opting out of it and asking developers to do something better, but anybody else?
I just want to confirm. So our conclusion is when there is no parking required, like say one place has no parking, we are not requiring EV charging.
Correct.
Yes.
That's what I hear.
Okay. Thank you.
The rest of mine was just an aside and a bit of a rant. Sorry.
No, you'll see this again. This isn't your last time to comment.
Okay. Let's move on to number four then. Accessible parking. Should we require it? So when we're looking at this, is this, if there's no parking at all, should we still require accessible parking? Is that how we should read this question?
Yeah.
Potentially? Okay. And if we do, what's the rate? What are people's thoughts?
Yeah. So again, I'll bring back what's required in the building code, just so you have those numbers. So, if there's a gap,
For the next time we talk about it, can we have that number? I don't.
Yeah.
I don't ever remember what it is.
I don't either.
Okay. But good. So absent that, what does everyone think?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Lauren, thank you, sir.
Yes, ADA parking should be required, and it should also be more required. I would like to see more spaces available in neighborhoods. on the streets, have them designated. If someone is disabled, that's a big decision of where they choose to go and shop and spend money. And locate that ADA parking near the front door.
I think current requirements generally associate ADA parking with the total amount. So, and I'm just going to ask you personally, do you find less parking in smaller, in like less ADA parking in places that don't have very much parking currently?
There's no ADA parking in North City in the neighborhood. I mean, there is at the Safeway.
Okay.
There isn't in Ridgecrest.
Okay.
There are days I go shopping on Sundays at Central Market or Town and Country Market that the ADA spots are full.
Mm. Okay, so, thank you. I appreciate that input. Yeah, I think percent as a function of the total doesn't acknowledge the need for smaller, you know, for it to be bigger in smaller parking lots. But I think as far as rates and numbers, it feels like we need more information a bit.
Yeah.
To go on how we would adjust it.
Yeah.
So, like, I've gone to Queen Anne a couple times, and along Queen Anne Avenue, there's lots of ADA spots, and that's great. They're always taken when I go. And so I'm driving around looking for the spot closest to the ADA spots, but I like that they are. It's possible I might get one.
In the red, like, on the street?
Yeah.
Like, doesn't, you know,
they have, like on the corner by, there's a game store close from a place that used to be a butcher.
Mm-hmm.
There's like five ADA spots kind of right just off Queen Anne Avenue.
So back to curb management.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all connected. All 272.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Cool. Bradley, Michelle. You don't have to.
I just wanted to say I support when we do not have minimum parking requirement, we should up the accessible parking. But I don't know what is the number, but yeah.
I agree. I think it does make sense to have a minimum, at least ADA for requirement. Again, I would like to see some of the other building code numbers, but yeah, I agree.
I mean, I agree in principle. I do want, as we look at where it's required, as we're thinking of not having shopping centers with large parking lots, that we, because this is not necessarily a building code or land use code thing as much, it's also working a right of way. Like I'm thinking of Richmond Beach Road, right by the grocery store where the road is constructed, where there's not the possibility at the moment of even having street parking.
Yeah.
And so as you reimagine those things, how does the right of way actually work? And could you provide those at the street? Because we are trying to, that code we just created, the comprehensive plan talks a lot about sidewalks and businesses fronting sidewalks, and so that changes the nature of it. But yes, so yes to the question with some qualifiers. Okay. Anyone else? Leslie?
I have one more general comment. First of all, thank you for providing the links in the staff report. I thought it was great to sort of see what other people were doing and get my head wrapped around this, so thank you for that. Somewhere in it, don't remember where, it was mentioned the idea of unbundling parking from housing,
mm-hmm.
and requiring that. Is that also in consideration as we're talking through this?
You mean the cost of parking?
The idea that when you rent an apartment, you would separately pay for parking versus paying for it as part of your rent.
Yeah, it's currently unbundled in the code.
It's required to be unbundled?
Yes, it's unbundled right
okay.
now.
Okay,
yep.
Never mind, then we've already done it.
And that was, I think we did that through an amendment maybe like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't too long ago, right? Because, yeah.
Way to make me look bad.
We didn't do it.
I didn't
like
do
5 years before that.
It was before us.
We bundled it, and then we unbundled it.
Great. Okay. Thanks. That's great.
Yeah.
Those are the questions. Anyone have any parting thoughts on parking? No? No? Not today for Leslie?
Could bring some more questions later. There's. Yeah.
Excellent.
Next time.
Next time.
Next time.
We're doing good. All right.
Yeah.
Well, if Steve has nothing else, I think that brings us to the end of our study items tonight. Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Next, unfinished business. Do we have any unfinished business? Don't think so. That brings us to our new business tonight, which is the election, this year's election of the chair and vice chair for the Planning Commission.
Okay, are you ready?
Carla's in charge of the first part.
All right. So as you know, the rules of procedure state that the chair and the vice chair elections be held at the first April meeting of the year, and the positions are for 1 year with a limit of 2 consecutive years. So all of you at this time are eligible for both positions. So I'm going to elect the chair first, and then the chair will take over elections of the vice chair. And first I'm going to call for nominations, and then once those are closed, I will take a vote. It's as simple as that, I think. So I will open it up. I will open it up for nominations. And you don't need a second for the nomination.
I'm going to nominate Leslie to be the chair this year.
Okay.
Or Commissioner Brinson, to be proper with our minutes.
Okay, Commissioner Brinson has been nominated. Are there any other nominations? All right, then. I will, then I'm going to close the nominations for chair, and I will ask that you, all in favor, show with a, signify by raising your hand. Thank you. All right, thank you. It's passed 6, that is a majority, and Chair Brinson will take over. Thank you.
All right. Now, I will call for nominations of the Planning Commission Vice Chair. Someone has to nominate Chris.
I nominate Chris.
See, it can always go sideways, Carla. Wait for the next year. Commissioner Chris has been nominated. Are there any other nominations? Hearing none, nominations are closed, and we will vote. All in favor of Commissioner Chris for vice chair, please raise your hand. All right, Commissioner Chris, you have been elected vice chair of the Planning Commission.
See, we stopped using the last name.
We did. Does that mean I have to finish, or you're going to finish? Oh, what do I have to do? All right, we have done that. Oh no, Planning Commission rules of procedure update.
Yeah. So, thank you. So we've let's see. Your rules of procedure dictate the order of the agenda for each meeting, and so what we've noticed with regard to public comment is that it can get a little clunky. The rules currently say that on study items, staff present, and then the commission receive public comment on the specific study item after the staff presentation and after clarifying questions from the commission. And so wanted to gauge the commission's temperature on entertaining an amendment to the rules to basically consolidate all public comment to the front end of the agenda, receive general public comment and comment on any specific study items all kind of near the top of the agenda. That way anyone attending the commission meeting wanting to weigh in on a specific topic, they're not sitting through maybe a couple of agenda items, maybe a lengthy staff presentation, maybe some questions by commission. So this is something we've noticed, and it might help with the flow of the meeting and being respectful of the public's time.
Steve, it also is consistent with the council meeting, so the public's not confused. There's different procedures for commission than there is for council. This would just mirror each other.
So what we would propose is if there's some consensus tonight, we would bring this back at the next meeting for consideration. The commission would need to, I believe, take some action to formally amend the rules, but just wanted first to introduce this as a topic that we've identified and if there's interest in considering it.
This makes sense to me. Would anyone like to discuss?
I'll just share, when I staffed a school board, that's how it was done, where all public comment was at the beginning and it worked well.
Does it change any of the rules for public hearings? Because I know with that one, there was a format.
Right.
Would that still follow that format?
That's a great question. Yeah, this would not change the public hearing format. Yeah, so we would still do presentation, and then the chair would open the hearing and then receive comments specific to the hearing topic that evening.
Okay, thank you. I don't object to changing it.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Change.
All right, I think we're clear. Let's do it.
Okay.
I have to do things now. All right, moving on to the next item. Reports and announcements. Except for that I will be missing my first meeting officially as chair next time. The agenda for the next meeting, April 17th.
Let's see. So Carla's just reminding me, I guess I had an announcement.
Oh, we can back up.
So just reminder that we have scheduled tentatively the July 14th council dinner meeting to talk about trees and the kicking off the tree code update process. So just wanted to make sure that was on everyone's calendar since we're kind of landing in the middle of summer, and it'll be a Monday evening, same start time as we just had for the dinner meeting a few weeks ago. And then as far as agenda items for next meeting, so we will be introducing the critical areas code update, an introductory discussion there, and then we'll bring back the change for the rules of procedure we just discussed.
Great, thank you. Anything else for the good of the order, my friends? All right, we are adjourned.